I've been talking a fair amount the last few weeks here about meditation itself. And I'd like to try to stay with that at the same time, staying with that a bit, also incorporate Rich's suggestion of the theme of surrender. And I would like to begin the talk by reading a passage that's from the Buddha's first teaching. Now, a lot of things happened when he gave his first teaching. The most significant, perhaps, is that he brought into this world a teaching that had not been delivered or had not been brought forth before. He brought forth something that was completely original. He brought into this realm, this human realm, something that had never been heard before. And what he offered was not complex. What he offered was extremely direct and simple and immediately practical and relevant and easy to understand on the front side, but as you enter into the depths of it, very difficult, very subtle. And in fact, this first thing that I'd like to read basically describes how he almost didn't teach at all. So it went like this. This Dhamma, Dhamma is a Buddhist Pali word that means the truth. This Dhamma, which I have realized, is indeed profound, difficult to perceive, difficult to comprehend, tranquil, exalted, not within the sphere of logic, subtle, and is to be understood by the wise. If I were to teach this Dhamma, the others would not understand me. That would be wearisome to me, that would be tiresome to me. With difficulty have I comprehended. There is no need to proclaim it now. This Dhamma is not easily understood by those who are dominated by lust and hatred, basically by wanting and not wanting, craving and aversion. Those that are dominated by that, this Dhamma is difficult to understand. The lust-ridden, shrouded in darkness, do not see this Dhamma, which goes against the stream, which is abstruse, profound, difficult to perceive, and subtle. You notice he's repeating himself. As I have reflected thus, my mind turned to inaction and not to the teaching of the Dhamma. So then, what got him to teach? If that's what he was contemplating, if that's what he was reflecting on, if that's what was going on for him, why did he teach? And the answer is very simple, as the legend has been given to us. Because what we're describing here is a legend. It's not a story, and it's not a myth. It's an epic legend. It's not the only legend. There are other legends in the world. It's been told that the reason he taught was that several devas, which are Buddhist angels, they're beings that don't have a body like us. They're basically beings of light. Now, the closest we can kind of get to this sense of a being of light would be to imagine yourself as pure awareness. And everything else that's here that you might call yourself is gone. What you are is the light of pure awareness. What would that be like? What would that be like? We can imagine that and get a kind of a felt sense for it. We can get kind of a feeling for that, can't we? Pure awareness, awareness as light. Your being would be completely illumination, or completely illuminating. So as the teachings have it, as the legend has it, a few of these, whether it was two or three, not sure, but two or three, of these beings came to the Buddha. How they came, we'll never know. They came into his mind as thought. His own sensitivity, his own subtle sense, his inner vision, his intuition, or maybe it was a telepathic communication. They said, teach the Dhamma, the truth, teach the truth for those with little dust in their eyes. And with this teaching or suggestion, call it what you will, being given, he turned towards this world that we share, and he began to teach. Now what happens to some beings, and we have history of quite a few, when illumination, particularly full illumination, happens, they lose complete interest in this world. Duality is gone. They're not interested. There is no more interest. The body may still be here, but there is absolutely no interest in anything here. It's completely transcended. And these beings sometimes, and they're human beings, they just walk off into the Himalayas. Go into a cave. Some of them are there now. So why would a being who has been freed of every shackle, there is no more complication, there is no more bondage, there are no more problems, why would such a being come here? And the answer is very clear. To help us. It's out of love and compassion that the Dhamma exists in this world. And it's a love that is both temporal, palpable, through our senses, in our hearts, and it's a transcendent, unconditional love at the same time. Because that love, or that compassion, is very close to the very center of what the Dhamma actually is and what we actually are. In our essence. So you might reflect at some point in your life, or perhaps you already have, that it was a very good fortune, it was a very good thing that the historical Buddha, among other illuminated beings, chose to teach, chose to be here and share. In fact, in his case, that was all that he did for 45 years, nonstop. Nonstop, till the last breath. And the last breath was preceded by a teaching. And it's a teaching that is so simple, I would say not, on its front side, difficult to understand, perceive, know, and be, because ultimately what we're here for is to be the teachings. Not just think about them, not just feel them, not just know them, but to be them. That's the true awakening. Final teaching. Take no external refuge. Take the truth itself. Take the Dhamma itself as your refuge. Take no external refuge. Be a light unto yourself. Amazing teachings, amazing words. Be a light unto yourself. Feel into that. Not looking for the light somewhere else. You are the light. If you don't see that you're the light, then what the teachings proclaim is follow this, understand this Dhamma, penetrate into this Dhamma, feel this Dhamma, know this Dhamma, so you become this light that you already are. You see? You might have noticed that at some point during our sitting tonight, I believe it was the refrigerator was on. And then the refrigerator turned off. Was anybody aware of that? Mm-hmm. This is a little example of what awakening is like. Awakening is like the refrigerator turning off. In the sense that awakening is the falling away of the layering of, in Hinduism it's called Maya or illusion. It's the falling away of that. So every time when you're meditating or not, you hear something turn off, so-called outside of you or inside of you, consider that that is reminding you of what awakening is. Now things get a little bit more challenging in terms of what the Buddha had to say. Watch this one. He was a straight shooter, right from the hip. Clint Eastwood style. But probably not gritting his teeth. Watch this. Birth is suffering. Decay is suffering. Disease is suffering. Death is suffering. Sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair are suffering. To be united with the unpleasant is suffering. To be separated from the pleasant is suffering. Not to get what one desires is suffering. In brief, the five aggregates of attachment or clinging, the basis of the human personality structure, is suffering. What's sitting here right now are the five aggregates: body, feeling, mental formation, that's thoughts, ideas, imaginations, images, perception, that's the way in which things are seen, it's the angle or view, and consciousness. Those five things are what are sitting here that you call yourself. The combination of those and the way that they're configured for each of us is the formation of your personality. This is very interesting, I hope. Birth is suffering. Decay is suffering. Disease is suffering. Death is suffering. Sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair are suffering. To be united, as we are every day to some extent, with the unpleasant is suffering. To be separated from the pleasant, as we are to some extent every day, is suffering. Not to get what one desires is suffering. It happens almost every day for many human beings, if not most of us. Not getting what we want. And then in brief, I would say in large, the five aggregates of body, feeling, mental formation, perception, consciousness, when clung onto as myself, as who I am, as what I must protect, as what I must feed, as what I must control, as what I must secure, as what I must invest in and believe in, as what I must protect. Did I already say that? That's a big one. As what I must protect, as who I am. This is suffering. This is what he said, number one. This is what he said right out of the chute. He didn't warm up to this. Of course, he was talking to his five companions who had been meditating along with him, so maybe he figured they were pretty warmed up themselves. So let me hit him with the best stuff right up front. He didn't tell him a few jokes and say, well, guys, you know, this is going to be a little bit serious. It's going to maybe be intense. Your mind might not like it. Your mind might say, you know, this is negative, pessimistic. This is about pain and sorrow and suffering. And what I'm looking for is enlightenment. I want the buzz, the tingle, the throb, the pulse. I want the light. I want a blast off. Do you? What do you want? Because if you, if I, if any of us do not know really why we are meditating, then why are you meditating? Would you like to leave when it's time? Actually, before you leave, be here. Free from fear and confusion and clinging. Not to say that you just become that illuminated, boundless space of awareness and everything else falls away, like those devas. But if you're interested in the potential reality, not a fantasy, not a dream, not an idea, not a concept, the reality of freedom, then the Dhamma can help. That's what it's about. Everything else is secondary at best. Next piece. This all came out in the first teaching. First talk. All worry about the self is vain. The ego is like a mirage, and all the tribulations that touch it will pass away. Get that? Everything that touches the sense of self that feels separate from everything else, everything that touches that will pass away. These tribulations will vanish like a nightmare when the sleeper awakes. Don't you like it when you wake up from the nightmare? Even though you might be going, whoa, that was interesting. That was deep. I was sitting in a dream last night, and someone that I know from the waking state appeared. Because you don't have to know the person in the waking state to meet them in the dream, do you? You can meet people that you want to meet in the waking state in your dream. You can meet people that you don't want to meet in your waking state in your dream. Anyways, a person that I know shows up in the dream. And she's not talking to me, but she's communicating. And then she says, I want to show you what happened to me. And she takes her hand and she holds it up. And her ring finger is missing right here. And the last time I saw her in the waking state, that had not happened. Sadness emerged and filled us. As sadness emerged, her body began to contract. Her face went into itself, kind of like one of those sci-fi movies, and she began to disappear. As she began to disappear, the sadness went away, and everything over here became calm and still. Some people who are into dream interpretation would have a heyday with that one. And let us work on what that means for you, Paul, and your personality, and the symbolism, and the dissolving, and the missing ring finger. Yes, the mysterious missing ring finger. Maybe we could keep it very simple for now. They will vanish like a nightmare when the sleeper awakes. All tribulations. He, she who is awakened is freed from fear. He, she has become Buddha. Buddha simply means awakened. You ever think just the Buddha? Or Buddhas are Buddha? That's a thought, that's a belief. The Buddha is someplace else. Some become the Buddha and some don't. I could never be a Buddha. I'm not good enough. I have too many swear words in my head. I'm too horny. I like things too much. I don't like things too much. I'm too judgmental. I hate myself. I like myself too much. I haven't understood the Dhamma enough. I need to meditate more. I need to stop being so compulsive about my meditation. I need to not be afraid of death. Yes, I'll need to not be afraid of death. If I'm not afraid of death, then I'll be the Buddha. And I don't know what your mind says, whether it says anything at all, but it's very important to see what your mind says. Because the Dhamma is about at least right close to the front door being truly in touch with the direct experience of life. That means not too lost, caught in, magnetized by, hypnotized by what's going on in your head, but rather feeling through things like the senses in the body. There's a living, dynamic flow of content that make up the five aggregates. That content flow is your traits, your personality, your biographical history, your dreams, your fantasies, your wants, your daymares, your nightmares, your dreams where you're smiling and laughing in the dream, your dreams where you wake up crying with joy, if that's ever happened. It's an interesting way to wake up, out of a dream into the waking state. He who has awakened is freed from fear. He, she has become Buddha. He, she knows the vanity of all his cares. Interesting. He, she knows the vanity of all his cares, his ambitions, and also his pains. Interesting words, huh? The vanity of those things. You could translate that as taking it personal. You want to know what anatta or non-self means? It means not taking it personal. And it's funny because as that opens up, you can, in a playful way, within yourself, so to speak, and with your friends maybe, take something very personal for a while and then be laughing about it. You know it's not serious. the great master of Buddhist meditation, Syaji Ubakin, was an accountant general of the country of Burma before it was taken over and renamed as Myanmar. He held four high posts in the government of Burma simultaneously, including the accountant general. And he taught intensive meditation retreats regularly to people who were inside the extremely corrupt government offices. So you could call that five jobs. In his meditation pagoda, which is a center for meditation where people sit in cells, and in the center of the pagoda sits the meditation teacher, and he goes out and has the interviews with the students. It's not a meditation hall, it's a meditation cell. It's not a prison cell, it's a cell for meditation. It's a liberation cell. Isn't that what prison's supposed to do? It's supposed to rehabilitate you. It's supposed to free you from your insanity, your shackles, your misfortune, your mistakes, your crimes, so you can walk out and realize and live more of your freedom. And what's fascinating is there are people who are in prisons that men and women have made who are freer in their hearts and minds than people who are walking around outside of these prisons. You don't have to take my word for it. You can go and visit. Find out. Watch the imagery here. It easily happens that a man, woman, when taking a bath, steps upon a wet rope and imagines that it's a snake. Horror will overcome and he will shake from fear. Anticipating in his mind all the agonies caused by the serpent's venomous bite. What a relief does this man experience when he sees that the rope is not a snake. The cause of his fright lies in his error. His ignorance, his illusion. That's where the fear is. It's in the misunderstanding. If the true nature of the rope is recognized, his tranquility of mind will come back to him. He will be relieved, and he'll feel joyful and happy again. This is the state of the mind of one who has recognized that there is no self. That the cause of all his troubles, cares, and vanities is a mirage. A shadow, a dream. The cause of all of the misery is a mirage, a shadow, a dream. We're not talking now about the effect. We're talking about the cause. The cause itself is a mirage, a shadow, a dream. You look at your shadow. You can put your hand through it. You awaken in the morning from your dream, and you know it's transitory, it's over. If you liked the dream, you may reflect on it for a while. You may do a dream interpretation, tell your friends. If you didn't like the dream, you might do the same thing. You might notice that there was a feeling there was a view there was some form of body there. There was mental cognition there, and there was consciousness there, otherwise none of it would have been recognized. That's what's happening here right now. The end of the mirage, the end of the dream, the end of the shadow, is to simply see. You don't have to have an out-of-body, Deva-like experience to see what this is. Even while you may still be invested in believing in its value, even as your vanity continues. Anybody in this room free from vanity, by the way? How would you surrender your vanity? The little boy at the World Cup preliminary soccer match in South Africa, as his team is losing, he takes the ice cream cone and starts painting his face with it. And as the camera shows him painting his face, and I suppose he realizes there's a camera pointing at him, he gets it painted with the ice cream and he smiles into the camera. Vain? Empty of vanity? Every single day, actions take place through these body-mind processes that are completely selfless. You have no investment in the result. You don't need it to go this way or that way. You are carefree. When you are carefree in that way, what's been surrendered is the illusion, the mirage, the dream of being a separate self. The separate self view, perception, idea, or as the Buddha helped us with tonight, the dream, mirage, shadow. Actually doesn't even exist, except as a perception, an idea. That something in here, and for now we'll just call it ignorance, causes to move in this form in such a way that I now not only believe I am a self that's separate from that which is around me, but I'm vain about it. But if I've gotten some exposure to spiritual teachings that say, don't be vain, don't be egotistical, don't be like this, like this, like this, like this, be like this, which is a vain teaching in and of itself, I then try to not let anybody know that I'm really vain. I keep it under wraps. When I'm given a little bit of permission, I let it squeak. With a few who I can trust to not abandon me, because I'm that fragile. Yes, my personality is that fragile. It's that shaky. It's so shaky that I build it up, I puff it up, I pump it up in my bicep, in my idea, in my job description, to myself or someone else. And meanwhile, all I'm doing is blowing smoke. It is a mirage, a dream, a shadow. So who, anytime, ever, could surrender? The very idea that I am going to surrender, I am going to surrender, is this not a vain idea? And furthermore, if I invest in this idea that I am going to surrender, how do I do that? Feel my feelings, not get defensive, listen to you closely, even ask you to tell me more about what I can't see about myself that you might be able to see. read up on the subject of what somebody else is saying about surrender and try to figure out how to practice it? Sure, if I'm busy spending moments of this stream of exaltation, that's really what the Buddha was saying. The Dhamma, realization of the Dhamma, is exaltation. This exaltation, I'm busy resisting because I'm waiting to feel safe here, waiting for somebody to love me or at least listen to me, like me, remember me. And we might have heard it over and over in our lives in different contexts. The way out of the prison, if you even know and feel you are in one, because some people don't know they're in the prison of their mind, even as they're in the stone prison for their crime. So I set up my program for myself to sort out this possibility that I could surrender. Maybe I do it like that. What would you do if it was impossible to surrender? What would you do if there was no physical death of the body? What would you do if this, right now, was eternity? Would anything be different, or would you just get up tomorrow morning and play it out without that consideration that I just described influencing? Can the personality surrender itself to itself? When a butterfly inside a cocoon comes forth out of the cocoon, is it considering that it must surrender the cocoon? Or is it just popping out? When you're holding your breath, and it becomes an issue, do you believe that you've surrendered as the breath starts to flow freely again? If you're having a feeling and it hurts, and you're aware that you're resisting the feeling, that you don't like the feeling, that you're beginning to consider a way to get away from it, to avoid it, something else is becoming interesting to you as a distraction. Are you running away from the possibility of surrendering into the feeling? Who could possibly surrender? And the answer may be, you think you can. So if you think you can surrender and then you do, where are you? Where do you get to go? To the other place? The other side? Do you then get the thing that you wanted, that you dreamed about, that you hoped for, that the scriptures said you'd get? awakening simply shows you, in one sense, that as this, bless you, falling away of misunderstanding, ignorance happens, all that really happens is you become more here. You don't go someplace else. So, I didn't say a lot about meditation, did I? And I was attempting to start with that and stay with that. So here's a piece. If you're sitting or moving through your day and you realize that you're busy resisting the flow of experience, then you could think that as you relax that resistance, and I would suggest to you to check out who's relaxing, see if you can find that one that's relaxing, and you won't be able to, but go ahead and give it a shot. Look for the one who's relaxing, and if you accomplish that, then you might feel that that flow of life, that flow of content, that flow of feeling, of thought, of perception, I don't know what was going through you as we sat tonight, but it's basically the same for all of us in different configurations. It's the five aggregates unfolding. If it hurts more, it's because there's clinging and attachment to those things. If it hurts less, there's less clinging and attachment. If it doesn't hurt at all, then there's no clinging or attachment. It's that simple. Who clings or attaches to the five aggregates? My idea of myself does. As that is seen, as that is looked at, because most people have one of these aggregates that they tend to cling on to more than the others. Is yours the body? Is yours the feeling? Is yours the perception? Is yours the mental activity? Or the consciousness? Which is it? You can know this. All you need to do is look. Without any time frame. Without any expectation that your looking will bring a result in a certain time. Because if you're looking in that way, then you're impatient. The Dhamma that's already here will wait forever for you to catch up with it, because it's not going anywhere. And as my first Vipassana teacher said, if some people don't get it now, maybe they'll get it the next time around. And he smiled. Obviously, there's a belief in continuation there in another life. You don't need that belief. You might like that belief. But unless you know that's true, it's a belief. If you think you're not getting it together yet in these ways, then you could invest in that belief and say, okay, I've got an insurance plan, I'm going to get another shot. I think I'm doing pretty good, at least I won't come back as a cockroach. I feel like I've transcended that at least. I probably won't end up as a worm. But what if you did? What if the worm and the cockroach are already manifesting Buddha nature and you're the one who isn't? Wouldn't that be a flip? And furthermore, what if the cockroach and the worm actually knew that they were manifesting the Buddha nature, not manifesting it unconsciously, and you're the one that doesn't know it? What if this is starting to sound nightmarish? What if everyone else that you looked at was manifesting consciously the Buddha nature, and you're the only one that's not? Psychotic, schizophrenic trance. What happens is, we would love, in a way, to let go of everything that seems to be in the way of that which we imagine to be our goal or our birthright. We would love to figure out how to do that, unless it rubs up against that which you cherish in the form of cling on to. You see, I'll let it all go, but don't take my children away from me. I'll let it all go, but don't take my youthful attitude. I'll let it all go, but don't take that particular kind of happiness away. Don't take away my ability to concentrate. Don't take away my freedom of movement in my legs. Don't take away. Don't take away. Don't take away. I'll let go all the way up to that point, but don't take that away, please. Can I keep that? There's your prison. There's your castle, prison. I'll let all that go, but don't take that one away. Don't take away love. Don't take away. Don't take away. See, the great, great good news is that when there isn't any clinging or holding to the idea that you're a self, that you will hopefully eventually perhaps surrender beyond, because that's all that self is the perception of separation. That's not a problem. That doesn't have to be removed. What falls away through this illumination is the investment in it. And then these five aggregates and all that make up the nuances of the ways in which they touch one another, and oh, is it interesting to see how they touch one another. Feelings and thoughts and body and perception and consciousness mixing and matching and moving and changing. Every moment's new and different, never the same. It's a party. Unbelievable. It's an enlightenment to simply see that every single thing, every second is fresh and new. But I don't always feel that because I think it's mundane or it looks the same or there's someplace else where it's going to be more alive and real and true. That's the dream. That's the mirage. That's the shadow. Actually, what's happening here, to stay with the surrender theme, is surrender is happening all the time as perpetual change. The Dhamma is surrendering itself unto itself every single moment. And this, however it's happening, is inescapably part of that. Not just the refrigerator when it clicks off. I'm turning into my driveway, coming home from work, having the thought it'll be nice to see my son. And a bird with white underneath the wings and white underneath the tail flies down the windshield of the car, just nice and smooth, and lands. And the mind says, isn't that nice? Is the bird busy surrendering itself to its flight? Is it busy surrendering itself to its landing? Is it busy saying, I have white spots? Look at me. I also have a white tail, which is even cooler than my white spots. It appears to have no self that it needs to surrender. We're the only characters that seemingly have this self that we think we're going to surrender. How can the self surrender itself unto itself? Let me pause now and see what's arising for you.